I'm Cyndi Lauper with fellow Cosentyx advocate, Chef Michelle Bernstein.
We'll share our experiences with plaque psoriasis, with psoriatic arthritis, and Dr. Panico will talk about the possible connection.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis 300 milligram dose and adults with active psoriatic arthritis 150 milligram dose. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for TB. Serious allergic reactions, severe skin reactions that look like eczema, and an increased risk of infections, some fatal, have occurred. It may lower your ability to fight infections, so tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if IBD symptoms develop or worsen. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or cosentyx.com/Cyndi.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 5. South Dakota seemed like the perfect place to unplug. But I ended up connecting to the world around me. A world where each sunset was painted, where I felt adventures pulse with every step, and where cold water trickling, pine swaying, and grunting bison became my favorite soundtracks. I just wish I didn't have to leave. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Weekly Squeak, your weekly geeky squeak with me, Christian Chiller. A little bit of a tech angle on the articles this week, crossing over a little bit into history and games and a few of the other things I love, but mostly from a technology perspective. And I also have an interview with Matt Billman from Netlify, a service that is amazing if you have a use for it. And that use is predominantly static site hosting, HTML site hosting, plus a bunch of other services, which is what we'll discuss. But in the meantime, let's get stuck straight into the links. First is an article on Longread by Olivia Gershon, entitled We All Work for Facebook. This article digs not just into Facebook, but also Google Maps, Reddit, and a whole bunch of these other sort of free services where we all kind of or should know that we are really the product if we're not paying, and how we're almost kind of working for them. We are generating revenue for them. And some of the numbers here are actually quite stark. I think it's always been known that tech companies especially are somewhat efficient in terms of their revenue generation for the amount of staff they have. For example, Facebook makes $635,000 profit per employee, if it's 25,000 employees. Alphabet, Google's parent company, makes about $158,000 per worker, Whereas if you compare that to a more traditional business, for example, Walmart, it is just over $4,000. So you can see the huge disparity in those figures. And many would say, well, that's intellectual economy. But in Walmart, you don't generally create revenue for Walmart as opposed, well, it's, obviously you do when you buy something, but in addition to that, whereas with Facebook and Google, unless you are buying ads or you are buying other services like Google's handsets or Facebook's devices, et cetera, then you are making money for them by providing them information and interacting with the service, which is a very different paradigm, actually. To many of us, of course, these services don't really seem like work. They're not really. I mean, using maps, as the article suggests, to get from A to B is actually helping you. It's not work. But then, of course, the argument comes back that as we are actually generating revenue by using these tools for these companies, should they indeed be paying us? This is a conversation that comes up quite a lot. I've had this conversation with a few projects and people over the past few years. And unfortunately, none of the solutions or options that are proposed are ever quite convenient or usable enough, or of course, accepted by any of these companies to ever get any traction. I wonder if they ever will. It would be interesting if they ever did. I don't know how the revenue models of these companies would be affected, whether they would still make an income. I guess they probably would, because most people probably wouldn't take these options. I don't know if it would have to make it work. I guess it would have to be all or nothing, not opt-in. I don't know. It's an interesting idea that has come up time and time again without ever really having any major explanation of how it could actually work, which is what I guess interests me the most. Is it actually even a practical idea? And even then, this gets into other angles on this topic. I guess people, I already mentioned Reddit, but people who manage Facebook groups that are very busy, they're invariably doing it in their volunteer time. Should they get paid for that? I think this is a little harder, because effectively if you're running a service, then in theory you probably have some other ways of making revenue out of that service. And if that's a not-for-profit service, then there's grant funding and things like that. Just because Facebook is the platform that you use, it doesn't necessarily mean that Facebook should compensate you for that, I guess. It's a slightly different angle on the discussion. But I suppose it's more mentioning that all this free work that people are doing for these services is time-consuming and can burn them out. I know people who have run meetup groups, for example, and the even bizarre thing with meetup is that organizers are the ones who pay, which is kind of an interesting relationship. And fielding questions and dealing with complaints and handling logistics is time-consuming. And quite often, not always, it's not really someone's job to do so. But I suppose these are not necessarily new things. People have always been running things in their volunteer time. There's just platforms that kind of make money out of people doing that as well, which is a different addition to that equation. And then, of course, we get into the subject of user-generated content. The argument would be that, especially with something like YouTube, your content can make you money. But, of course, we all know that you have to get a lot of viewers before you actually make any significant income. And it doesn't necessarily mean that your efforts were any less effort. But again, I suppose we could argue that musicians, filmmakers, actors have been volunteering their time with hope of success for many, many years too. So is it necessarily anything new? Again, the thing that is new is that we are still making revenue for the platform, in theory. Although, of course, if you have very low viewerships, maybe you're not really. But again, a different angle on this perspective, I suppose. So I guess the summary of this article is, well, you should read it a bit more to find some of the numbers, especially that I haven't mentioned. But also, I suppose, think about what you're putting into these platforms. Think about what you get out of it versus what the company gets out of it. And maybe weigh that up a little bit sometimes to check if it's really worth it to you. Next, I feel like I have discussed this topic a little bit before, but it's something that fascinates me. This is on the outline from Joe Vey, I'm not 100% sure, called You Can't Beat an Unwinnable Game, But You Can Break It. This is about simulator games, sim games. I love sim games. SimCity, Civilization, I haven't played The Sims so much recently, but I did in the past. These sorts of games are these kind of open worlds with no real conclusion. I mean, Civilization, for example, kind of has win conditions, but then you can keep going. I guess you keep going until there's nothing more to do. And this article recounts the story of Vincent Urquhart, who kind of did something similar with SimCity 3000. He claimed he had beaten it. Well, as I say, there isn't really a win condition, but he'd kind of taken it to the extremes he could. He's actually an architecture student in the Philippines, so he kind of, I suppose, should know how to design a city. He painstakingly designed, without any cheats, this very complex and dense city that had basically become the kind of most efficient city that was possible in SimCity 3000 in terms of revenue, etc., etc. But of course, yes, and you guessed it, the place for a real human would have been horrible to live. And he'd actually been planning this for nearly 4 years on paper first before implementing it in SimCity 3000 and then let it kind of run its course. The city is called Magnazanti, and you can see some pictures of it even in the main shot of this image. In fact, the corner they've chosen on this image, it doesn't look so bad. I can see, I think, a space station. I'm not 100% sure. It has over 6 million people in the city. It's full of enormous towers, which I've actually been playing City Skylines recently, and this, again, seems to be the main way to build an efficient city. And, I mean, many would argue that high-density living or even medium-density living is really the only way to maintain cities and the demand for cities, but that's another discussion. There's next to no green in the city, but there is no water pollution, no traffic, or no crime, or no vacant buildings, or anyone over 55. I don't remember ages even being a thing in SimCity 3000, or at least them making a difference, but it's quite fascinating. It's a bit Logan's Run. It's sort of, urban perfection with the want of nothing else. But I think also the thing about the no traffic is that there's no roads, I think, or very few roads. So there's no traffic because there's nowhere for them to go, I guess, is the interesting thing there. I've often found it very hard to build cities in SimCity and City Skyline without roads. So I'm quite fascinated how that managed to work. And there is a YouTube video that you can watch, which I will do very soon, because I find this stuff quite fascinating, as I said. The article then goes a little bit more into catastrophes that you can then rain down on your city. And I remember in the original SimCity, these could happen more randomly, but you can still bring them down on yourself too. And there's some other great videos in this article of people doing this to their cities, building up these perfection and just destroying them, which, of course, I'm sure there's something to be said in there about all sorts of aspects of human psyche. But again, that's probably best saved for another conversation. But interestingly, this story or these stories of people isn't necessarily without its origins. The creator of SimCity, Will Wright, claims to have got his initial idea for the game after losing his home and all his possessions in a fire. And he started to wonder about all the things we have and how we purchased them. I don't exactly know how that led to SimCity. It seems a bit more minute, maybe more like The Sims than SimCity to me. But he did go on to create The Sims afterwards, so maybe it was kind of a long game, shall we say. And this actually, again, I think feeds into a little bit of real life, these sorts of huge concrete slabs that were put up in the 60s that were supposed to give everything that the citizens needed apart from life and soul and feeling and human needs. It's just like a box, but an efficient box. And yes, Escala's creation has no public resources like schools or hospitals. There's next to no employment. It's crowded and it's ugly. And again, I think this is where it gets interesting with a game like SimCity, because the game will encourage you to have these things, but it doesn't necessarily stop you playing the game. I've been on my own agenda trying to play a game of Civ 4 or 5 without having any religion, and I have not allowed an official religion. I've not built any churches, but of course the people still celebrate some faith. I just don't sanction it at all. So, you know, it's the interesting thing with these open worlds. You can have these experiments and go against what the game wants you to do, and see how that plays out. And sometimes that could lead to some interesting things. Sometimes the game may break, I guess, in this case, where you've kind of found a way around its constructs. Anyway, all quite fascinating. I really recommend you have a look at this article and watch all the videos. If you're a fan of these games or just a fan of, I guess, modeling life, I suppose. Now, two Microsoft browser-related articles. First is an article from Chris Zacharias on his blog, A Conspiracy to Kill IE6. Anyone who's ever done any web development will remember the dark days when we had to use IE6. And there are still many of these dark days with us in many enterprise companies, especially where they don't want to break custom software that only ran in IE6 and all its non-browser standard glory. And whilst these users are decreasing, they are still there. But what happened to bring its downfall in the first place? And this is a really interesting tale of rebelliousness within YouTube, just as it was taken over by Google. When the engineers there wanted to build, you know, a Web 2.0 application but were constantly hitting the issues and restrictions that IE6 placed upon them, and basically went a little bit rogue and decided to, instead of actually breaking the site, put a banner above the video player for any IE6 user saying that the site will stop working in the near future. Of course, that's all it really was, actually. It was just this banner. And quickly, this spread around the rest of Google as well. It had turned out that the Google Docs team were intending to do something quite similar. And slowly but surely, this actually made people start upgrading, even though no one was planning to break anything in the near future anyway. And finally, they were able to update their sites and stop building in features that would only work for a small percentage of users, because this is what project managers at the time and product managers at the time felt was needed to keep these users. So if you are old enough, like me, to remember the dark days of IE6, in fact, I even remember IE5 and 4, so just going back, and probably before that, they're just the ones I remember developing with and for. IE5.5 was the last Mac version, and I did used to use it. I remember the About Us box and how the browser Chrome looked. But if you are from that era, you might find this a fascinating story. Maybe you even remember it. I still don't even use YouTube very much these days, to be honest with you. So I don't use it. I didn't use it very much then either. So I don't remember it myself. But if you do, then have a read. And likewise, maybe get inspiration for your own internal company struggles where you're attempting to make a change. Maybe this kind of tactic could help you too. On the complete flip side of this, a more recent story on The Verge from Tom Warren called Inside Microsoft's Surprise Decision to Work with Google on its Edge browser. So the browsers are now consolidating how the tide has turned into mostly using the Chromium engine. Chromium is mostly developed by Google, but Chromium and Google Chrome are not necessarily the same thing. There are other browsers built on top of Chromium too. But Microsoft is a new company. They don't consider their rivals anymore. So this is a really interesting article on how the engineers at Microsoft, instead of going against the competition, because I think they have also realized that going against that competitor is kind of too hard now, they decided to work with them and work on improving Chromium together for the needs of both companies, which is a really great story to hear and happens far too rarely, actually. This includes commits into the upstream projects, especially into Chromium, from Microsoft engineers, and a little bit of vice versa, although mostly from Microsoft at the moment, and basically learning from these lessons, because much like Google Chrome, Microsoft is looking to make this browser universal, not just a Windows 10 application, but macOS and mobile versions in the long run too, and possibly even Linux, because they're a Linux company now. Who knows, and it remains to be seen, if the new relaunch versions of Edge will be popular or not. Microsoft obviously has form, see previous story, of forcing browsers into Windows users' hands, and the last version of Edge didn't necessarily work so well. But was this because of it wasn't a viable alternative to Chrome, or was it because Chrome was just established in people's mindset? Who knows? But it's at least nice to see that even in the long run, if the browser is not successful, these engineers are contributing back to another project. And flipping back to Google again now, an article on ZDNet from Stephen J. Vaughan Nichols, an article on how Chrome OS will now, from Google I/O's recent announcement, all support Linux as well as Chrome OS. This is not new news, but it was reiterated and I guess kind of made more official and has been increasingly happening in Chrome OS since that announcement, previous I/O. So now you can open up a Chrome OS app switcher, get a terminal open, and then you can start installing Linux distributions. Debian is very easy. You can also get Ubuntu relatively easily, Fedora, and I guess some others if you want to play. This is fascinating. I think I brought this up a couple of months back around the fact that Microsoft and Apple are both sort of, I guess, losing enthusiasm for their desktop operating systems. And Linux maybe will end up being the last remaining proper desktop operating system for people who want a bit more control. But Linux has always had this kind of mindshare issue, and maybe having a company like Google pushing it through its own Chrome OS, which is limited as an operating system, will bring it to a whole new audience, even if I would hazard a guess that many Linux aficionados would not necessarily want a company like Google to be doing that for them. But sometimes the strangest people end up being your allies. So I look forward to seeing reactions from the community on whether they think this is good or bad. And finally, this is actually kind of a whole series of articles on Technology Review and also MIT Download magazine that I read last week, but I picked this one out particularly from Karen Howe about the team behind DeepMind, and there were some others that were also discussing this last week around new, more general artificial intelligences for playing games. So this is the team that initially had DeepMind playing Go, and now they want to teach it to play a game called Hanabi, which I have played. Hanabi is quite fascinating. You're trying to create sets of cards with your co-players, but you can't see your cards. Only your co-players can see your cards. So there's a lot of social interaction, and this is why the team are trying to figure out how you can make an artificial intelligence play this. And some of the other articles around this subject this week were around getting artificial intelligences to attempt to play Magic the Gathering. Sort of for a different reason, in that Magic the Gathering has so many nuanced rules and counter rules and contradictory rules that you often need human input to figure out what these contradictions might end up being. So the kind of wooliness is somewhat difficult to program an artificial intelligence with. And this, with the Hanabi example, it brings up interesting challenges that AI has not really had to tackle before, or not in this context. I guess being able to pick up implicit information or human hints, the vagueness of human language. So I think it's numbers and colors in Hanabi. So you might say to someone, you have 2 threes or something like that, and figuring out what that could mean. Because it's not a complete game board like chess or Go, the AI doesn't have access to all the information it needs. It only has partial access to that information, which is, again, a very different challenge for an artificial intelligence. And they do have an open source environment, of course, where they counter some of these challenges that you can dig into and see how well it handles it. If you know the game, or even this just sounds interesting to you, then jump over to the article and find those details and see how well it does. I think this is sort of early days. It's not as a kind of, it's actually quite, in many respects, it's quite novel and groundbreaking, but it doesn't seem to be as newsmaking as the Go and chess. And I'd also recommend you, I'll link this somewhere. It was recommend you go and take a look at this article around the Magic the Gathering side of things too. I have found the topic of kind of general game engines quite interesting because humans, of course, can interpret rules and then figure out how to play it, but an AI has to be told rules and understand rules before it can play. So it's one of these strange things where humans are still exceeding right now. And that was my links for the week. An interesting mixture. Artificial intelligences, we had games, we had some technology history, all the good things in my mind. Next, another good thing and a product that I love and have been using for a long time, and I don't know why it's taken me so long to get one of the people from Netlify on the show, but I have an interview with Matthew Billman from Netlify, talking a little bit about the platform, but then specifically a feature they just announced, which is Netlify Dev. Enjoy.
My name is Matt Billman, and I'm CEO and co-founder of Netlify. Netlify is a platform that allows developers to build, manage, and deploy modern web projects, really centered around this idea of decoupling the front-end presentation layer from the back-end layer. And we sort of have specialized in taking care of that whole front-end layer, whether it's something you built with static site generators, or whether it's single-page applications, or anything in between.
And you, I guess in the world I operate in, it feels like you're everywhere, but the world I operate in is a niche world. So, for example, Netlify has been very popular with documentation sites, especially for open source projects, because you're very friendly to them.
We probably run about I think we can even say that we probably run the majority of the open source documentation sites in our space, right? So like React is on Netlify, Ember is on Netlify, Vue is on Netlify, Hugo, Gatsby, and so on are on Netlify, and even tools like Kubernetes or Istio or anything like that is on Netlify.
And I'm currently trying to switch another project to Netlify right now. A ridiculous downloads folder, which I need to switch out, which will break your builds. So, I'm just.
You might be able to handle it with.
No, it's ridiculous. It needs to be moved. It needs to be moved anyway. It's in a GitHub repository, and it's dumb there. People have been complaining about it because every time they check out the project, it takes like 10 minutes to check out the project. So
It makes sense. We do have like the option that can like where you can offload those files to like something like an S3 bucket, even if, and then just keep pointers to them.
Yeah. And if anyone visits my personal website, christianchiller.com, that's also on Netlify, not the podcast, because that doesn't make sense to host a podcast with Netlify. But and a big fan of Netlify for quite some time. I used to work a lot with in the CMS world and sort of had a revelation with static site generators. And in the past worked at a company called Contentful, who also match up with a lot of what you're doing. And I know people won't be able to see this, but as far as I saw very briefly, you're wearing a Jamstack t-shirt, which a lot of these companies kind of correlate with. So maybe actually, what is Jamstack then? I know you've spoken about this on quite a few shows, and I think you even have your own show on this, or someone does. So what is Jamstack and how does that fit in?
Brian Douglas runs Jamstack Radio, right, and has for a long time. He's at GitHub now, but I mean, Jamstack stands for JavaScript APIs and markup. And as a term, it was a term we coined when we were sort of early in the days of Netlify, and in the early days. Today we are like much broader. We have serverless functions, a very flexible edge ending. We run a lot of applications as well as content-driven sites. But early on, we were also quite focusing on like really solving the issue of like how do you build great infrastructure around working with site generators that take some source and often combine them from tools like Contentful and so on, and then spit out like a pre-rendered site that you can put directly on a CDN, right? And we saw that there was these parallels to that process with the tools like Webpack and so on that would take a bunch of sources and spit out like the bundles for a single page application, and then you could put those on the CDN, or the whole idea of progressive web apps. And they all sort of circled around this idea that as the browser has become much more mature and much more powerful, instead of having like a traditional like web architecture where we have a very big monolithic application, like whether it's a Rails application or a WordPress site or a Drupal site or anything like that, right? The story was sort of always this three-tiered architecture with like your web server, your application server, and your database, right? And every request would go through that whole like monolithic system and spit it out. And each of those monoliths would sort of have their own plugin infrastructure, right? So you would have like WordPress would have their plugins, Rails would have their Ruby gems, Drupal had its own ecosystem and so on. And everything there happened inside this big monolith, right? So what we just started observing was like this architecture emerging where all of that got split up and where you would take like the actual front end layer and just build it as a static front end that you could put directly on a CDN, right? Like, and you would sort of reverse the flow with, if you depended on content, instead of pulling that content in at runtime, people would start doing things like talking to Contentful, right? And pulling in all the content at build time and then building out all the pages, right? And then from the client, from the browser, you would have this JavaScript-based runtime that would no longer talk to some specific origin server, but talk to all kinds of different microservices, right? Where some would be systems like Algolia and Stripe that other people host, and some might be built with serverless functions or your own microservice infrastructure or whatever, right? But but we just started seeing like this tendency that sort of united the space of static site generators, of progressive web apps, of single page applications. And they were all based on this basic idea of like pre-building a bunch of markup that can like be hosted directly on a CDN without some origin web server. And then use JavaScript in the browser as the main runtime and then talk to all these different APIs. And initially we just kept seeing that a lot of people were doing this and a lot of people were sort of going through all the words I just went through to describe what they were doing over and over again when we were talking to them, right? And we had to do the same all the time. So we really sort of discovered that we needed a word that could encapsulate that in the same way that in a way back in the day when someone wrote a blog post and coined the term Ajax, right? Like, That was like, it wasn't like a new invention, right? Like the XML HTTP request API had been in the browser for a long time, right? And Google had started building some application based on it and so on, right? But once someone sort of gave it a name and said, like, let's call it Ajax, it made it much easier for developers to communicate about and to build with, right? Just because suddenly you had like a vocabulary. And we kind of started feeling that this was similar, right? Like it wasn't that we were inventing something new or anything. It was just that there was really this need for putting a name on that architectural pattern so people could better sort of talk about all the interesting thing you can do with it or the patterns around it instead of just describing the workflow itself over and over again. And then we, like, at some point a friend of mine actually coined the term Jamstack, and I figured out what the acronym would stand for in a way, right?
I don't think I actually ever checked what it meant. Yeah. And now you just reminded me.
Yeah. And it was like JavaScript API and markup, right? And we started just talking to other players in the industry, right? Like I think one of the first ones was Tom Preston Werner, who obviously started GitHub, but also built Jekyll and was like an early pioneer in this, right? And he was also one of the first that said, "Yeah, like let's start calling it that because then we have a name, right?" And then we just gradually started like talking to more and more people, and I think that it just turned out also to be really useful to people, right? As a way of talking about this category. And now we're really seeing like a community around it. So the t-shirt is one I got when I went to the Jamstack conference in New York and talked there. And a small startup and also in the CMS space called TakeShape came there with their Jamstack t-shirts and gave them out. Right, so I got one of those. And it's just been really nice to see that kind of like community adoption of the term and seeing all the companies in the space that are now sort of huddling together around it and using it.
And so let's have a look specifically at Netlify and the I guess the role you play in this stack, which is a couple. So a lot of people would probably use Netlify in a very simple way in that you can hook up a project or repository running a wide variety of static site generators or just raw HTML.
You could set up triggers from Git builds or use a CLI tool to trigger builds, and you very quickly end up with an HTML site available, very fast, firstly because it's HTML, but secondly because you also have CDNs. That's kind of the base function of Netlify, but you also have a lot of other interesting features that start to add a lot of those components that people might have used the CMS for in the past. Things like identity and logins, which is very useful and something I intend to look into with a particular project I'm working on very soon, because that would be very useful for a certain use cases. You also have functions which are using Lambda functions from AWS for, I don't know, whatever you want to use a function for, I suppose. forms, which, again, lots of people would have created in CMSs in the past, and or on a lot of static sites these days would probably use an external service, but that goes somewhere else, so it's kind of a convenient way of keeping everything in one place. You've also just added the large media using Git LFS. Actually, maybe let's discuss that one a little bit, because that's relatively new as a feature. Yeah. And that starts to open up a lot of potential new use cases that people hadn't thought of before.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, Git LFS has been around for a little while, but you don't hear of that many people using it that extensively.
Nope.
So maybe let's have a quick chat about that feature and what you do with it and what you're hoping people might be able to do with it with Netlify.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so LFS stands for Netlify Large Media, right? We call it Netlify Large Media, and it's based LFS, which is a Git large file system, right? Which came from the fact that Git is like an extremely good version control system for anything that's text-based, right? It's based on these content addressable shards, and it gives you like a lot of really great characteristics to base your storage in this kind of content addressable shards, where every piece of content just gets a shard, and you can track if the content changes, the it will create a new shard, and you will have a new object, and so on, right? The problem with that is that as soon as you start working with very large files, every time you make any kind of change to that file, the whole object gets replicated in your repository and Git sort of starts becoming a very inefficient system. So Git LFS probably initially came out of things like video game companies and so on, wanting to keep their whole source code under version control. But figuring out that Git simply didn't work well for that, because these very big assets would be kept in the Git repository and you would get these humongously bloated Git repositories that started becoming slow to work with and painful and so on. So at some point, GitHub invented the Git LFS standard and open sourced it. And what it does is really that it allows Git to use like an external cloud-hosted object storage to put the actual objects in, and then just keep pointers in the local Git repository to those objects. So what you store in the Git repository is just a tiny little text file saying, like, we have this object stored in an object store somewhere, right? And we started noticing that for a bunch of content-driven sites, you would run into sort of the same issue, right? Like some sites, imagine you have sites that has a really big product catalog with thousands of images, right? Like that also starts giving you like terabytes of data, and you really don't want like a Git repository with terabytes of data in it. It's like, it's really not what Git was meant to be used for. And at the same time, what you really want when you manage that is that like you want to have those images actually stored in some kind of cloud service so they can be loaded very fast from the website, right? So it seems to us that Git LFS made for a really interesting like solution in that space where you could just start saying, okay, let's take all these large files and then just put it into a cloud service that Netlify can operate along with its normal file storage. And then only store the text files in the repository. And then we also saw that a lot of the site generators have implemented tools for things like image resizing and scaling images and so on, cropping and all of that are things that sort of the traditional CMSs has also been able to do on the fly. Because it's such a common part of like you make a template and you need like to use responsive images or you need to have thumbnails and the best way to do that is to be able to in the template language somehow just specify the images you want. But it's a part where again if you have like a really large image driven site and you use a site generator to do the image resizing, well, then every time you have a build, first you need to sort of fetch all of those images from a really large repository and run a long series of transformations to them and then upload all the different versions of them to a cloud service right during the deploy and so on. And it just becomes a fairly inefficient process. So what we did with Netlify Large Media was just saying like, let's make sure that any object that's stored in Netlify Large Media and that's an image, you can just specify some URL parameters and say like resize this to crop it to 200 times 200 and it'll just happen directly at the CDN level on the fly and you don't have to pull those down into the build and so on. Another thing that this opens up for that right now the use case is not totally supported. We still have a little issue around being better at streaming large objects from Netlify Large Media, but once that's in place, it'll be a good fit. Is things like you just mentioned podcast, right? Like it's another thing where if you're making a podcast with this approach, right? Like there's really no reason you wouldn't use a site generator for it, right? Like it's a very standard like blog type site where you have like articles and you have an RSS feed and so on, right? But what's holding it back is typically that you really don't want to store all of your blog, like all of the actual audio files in a Git repository again, because Git is really bad at that, right? But again, here you could just go and say like store any audio file in Netlify Large Media and then all you store in the Git repository is just a pointer file saying like this is the file, right? And now people can load those files directly from our cloud storage instead of every deploy sort of having to pull those down and then push them up and so on.
Yeah. It's a nice consistency tool because I know depending between the static site generator, some of the plugins or functions for resizing images can be a bit inconsistent.
Yeah.
I guess it also makes it easier to switch static site generators as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And also from a product perspective, it's I don't mean this in a bad way. It's a good way for you to make some revenue because,
of course,
media is expensive. Storing media is expensive, especially if you get into streaming. And you're going to be charging by a transformation. The free tier is $2,500, which sounds like a lot, but you know if you have 100 images and you make 3 transformations per image, that's already 300. So
we do cash the transformation, so it's typically a pretty reasonable rate even for large sites. But we do also, of course, like the bandwidth used from large media also counts against the general like bandwidth tiers we have, right?
And how do you, I mean, how at the moment it's mostly optimized for images, but if someone were to host like downloads, how would you monitor that from a bandwidth perspective, just purely the bandwidth?
That would just be the, then we would just be charging for the bandwidth basically.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, cool. But the new feature that you just announced, which I've been experimenting with and hitting a few issues, it is beta,
And do post them in our community or.
I will. I'm just trying to figure out if it's a Jekyll issue or a Netlify issue. So
okay.
I'll go back to that at a later date. So one of the issues with a lot of these kind of continuous build systems, and I know Circle has some concepts of this, Circle CI and a couple of other kind of CIs as well, is, you know, when you send everything off to a build service, a CI service to do some magic for you, you kind of lose a little bit of control sometimes about seeing if things are working. You sometimes have to wait for pull requests to complete before you could see if the change you made was useful or if it broke something, etc. So having the option to test some of these locally somehow is always a positive thing to be able to do. I mean, with a lot of the ways people use Netlify, it might just be basically rendering and hosting a version of a static site generator, so they can do that locally fairly easily. But with a lot of these new features, there might be other things they want to test.
Yeah.
So as far as I can understand, what Netlify Dev is basically a local version of your platform for people to be able to test these things. Yeah. But maybe just flesh that out a bit, just in case I missed a few things, or what your reasoning for releasing this feature was.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a big part of it has been there all since the beginning, right? Like as we started build out Netlify, part of what you could say we do is that we replace the web server, right? Like when you use Netlify, you no longer have a web server, right? Like and you no longer have some central origin, right? Like before that, you would always like put your site on some Nginx or Apache server somewhere, right? Like, and then you might put a CDN in front of it, right? But it was still like the site lived there, and general, typically all requests for the actual HTML pages would go all the way to that origin data center and talk to your web server and so on, right? And you can say one of the early things we did was build this globally distributed network where with Netlify you don't deploy your site to like a web server somewhere, right? Like it gets deployed all over the world. But that also meant that for more advanced users, of course, a bunch of the things that you used to do on your local web server, we have to give answers to, like, how do you do them at the edge? So early on, that was like first the really basic things, which is like redirects, right? Like anytime you port a project from one CMS to a new one, you typically always end up having to maintain a bunch of redirects for SEO purposes and so on, right? The other things were proxying, which was really common for things like single page applications, right? Where you want to get around course issues and you want to be able to talk to an API somewhere without going to another domain and so on. Then there's more advanced use cases like language or country-based redirects or rewrite rules for internationalization and localization. Yeah, yeah. And all of those were edge rules, right? And right since the beginning, we've been great at like having an extremely flexible rules engine that allows you to do a lot of those things directly on the edge. But of course, that also meant that while you're developing things, you didn't have like a great way of testing those locally and knowing if they worked, right? And so we've even had some community built libraries that tries to imitate our redirect engine and so on, right? But then it's again like it's not the real thing, right? Like you don't know for sure if it's actually working the same way as when you push to production. And then of course one of the big things we introduced was serverless functions. That also sort of comes with its own routing layer and sidesteps. Like before Netlify, right, when AWS Lambda first came out, it was really clear that there was this huge promise in being able to just write some functions, have a web endpoint, and not having to worry at all about where are those functions running and what does it take to scale them and so on, right? Like it's a very powerful concept. But then in practice, like, the workflow around like for every function, you need to sort of set up an API gateway endpoint. And now you need like a deployment process and CI/CD pipeline for that function. How do you tie like the staging version of that function to the staging version of your front end? And all of those things became quite cumbersome, right? And not super ideal to work with and kind of made it feel like having all these small functions was more of a workflow trap than a benefit, right? And so we came up with this concept of like, what if you could just have your functions in a folder in the same repository as your front end, and then every time you get pushed, those functions just go live on a relative path on your site, and you don't have to do anything. You don't have to deal with API gateways or anything like that, right? But then again, of course, that also means that people can build really advanced things with the combination of like a static front end and these functions, and it wasn't very ideal having to push to Netlify or push to a pull request or anything like that just to test if it works, right? So initially we made a library called Netlify Lambda that people could sort of integrate into their own tool chain, and then locally they could set up proxy rules and so on to get it to work like it would in production. But that's also quite a bit of a hurdle to jump through, right? And it's still not really the real deal. And then latest, we introduced our add-on ecosystem where the first partners are starting to build services that you can provision and set up environment variables and routing to directly just by writing like Netlify add-ons create FaunaDB or Netlify add-ons create TakeShape or whatever. And then again, like, that's great. You can do that, and then they work on Netlify and in our environment. And when you run your build there, we inject the right environment variables and we inject them into your functions and we set up all the routing and so on. But now, again, the same question becomes, how do you test that locally and how do you make it work locally? So with Netlify Dev, we really set out to say, okay, how can we make sure that you can run the whole platform locally in a really easy way? And one of the first steps we took there was the actual rules engine that runs at the edge. That's a rules engine written in C++, because of course everything we do at that edge layer, we want it to be extremely performant. So we took that whole engine and then compiled it down to WebAssembly. Okay. And WebAssembly, you can just load and execute from a node, from Node, right? So that gave us an easy way to actually like package that whole rule engine and make it part of a local dev server. And then we built Netlify Dev to like run this process where it will, when you start it up, it will try to detect the build tool you're using and find the right settings. And then it'll spin up the dev server native to that build tool. So if you're using Gatsby, it will spin up the Gatsby dev server with live reload and everything. If you're using jkl, it will spin up the jkl server and so on. And that's because often those servers have some specific logic to how their platform works, right? And we don't want to break that. We want to support that and make people able to iterate fast on those tools. But then we also spin up a little server that will run any of your Netlify functions locally. And then we spin up a third little server that just sits as a proxy and receives every request locally, runs our whole rules engine, detects if something is a path to a function or an add-on and everything, and sets that up. That will also sort of inject all the environment variables for your add-ons or from your Netlify site environment into your local functions or your local dev server and make sure all of that just works. And then really ties it all together. So that becomes really just like your simple local tool, right? And you can also use it, like you don't even need to have some specific build tool. If you just run it in a folder with a purely static site, we'll just spin up a static web server, right? But otherwise, we'll just try to detect which tool you're using and do the right thing. And then in case we can't detect it, you can define your own settings for it. And then another thing we saw was what you talked about, right? That sometimes when you're collaborating quickly, like you want to get some eyes on something, or you're working with a client and they have to see sort of in real time what you're doing or something, right? Mm. And again, that becomes a little cumbersome if every time you have to like run a build and do a deploy. And so we added this option of running Netlify dev -- live that will just immediately like run that dev server locally on your computer, but set up a live tunnel to a URL on under netlify.live that you can share with anyone, and they can then directly from that URL essentially access your web server running locally, which is really powerful for quick iteration.
That's quite cool. Yeah, as a lot of people will use other options for that.
Yeah.
And bundling it all together is quite cool, actually.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks. Glad you think so.
I still kind of need to play with this a bit more, because it's odd. Like you look at the page and it looks like, oh, this it's quite sort of a simple feature, and then you realize it's actually quite a lot you can do.
Yeah.
That isn't immediately obvious. Yeah. Yeah. And how well has it been received so far?
It's had an, like, we were like, you never, one of the things that's always super interesting when you launch a feature like this is that like we've been thinking of it for a long time, right? And we've really figured out how important it would be both now and both in sort of in tandem with the features we have on our roadmap and so on, right? So we were very convinced that thinking about Netlify really in terms of almost these three layers of Netlify dev for your local machine, Netlify built as the sort of collaborative tool with the web UI and so on, and Netlify Edge, where your actual site infrastructure lives, it made a lot of sense and would be really powerful from a product roadmap perspective and so on. But at the same time, when you launch something like this, right, you never know how well will it resonate, right? Will people, is it something you have to nurture for a long time to gradually get people to understand, why would I want that? Or is it something that people immediately see the need for and so on? And that's been really exciting, that like when we launched, people really got it, right? Like we got an amazing reception on Twitter and Hacker News and Reddit and so on, right? And there's really been genuine excitement around it. So that's something that we've been really like, that's really just confirmed our belief that it's going to be important, right? But it's also always nice to see when the community agrees.
Okay. And I mean, we've just talked about a new feature, but you do seem to have been moving quite quickly recently, seemingly anyway, with a lot of new features. What's next? What are you working on next?
Lots of things. I mean, a lot of things are incremental, right? So a lot of things is taking now what we just launched around Netlify Dev, and there's a lot of work still to do there, right? Like there's a reason we named it beta. We still want better support for our identity service, for forms, and for Netlify Large Media, and all of these things, right? So there's a whole roadmap just for that service, right? Like the same around functions. There's a lot of things we want to do there around the add-on integrations. There's a lot of things we want to push out there. Same in terms of just expanding. Like we have these very powerful rules engine running on the edge, but of course we're also looking to like, how can we make that even more powerful and even take it even further, what you can do there and what we can make easy and viable to work with directly at that edge layer. So there's a lot of things in store there. And then we do have a really nice thing brewing that I don't want to spoil yet, but that we are planning on launching at the Jamstack conference in July in terms of a new feature. It's something that we are like, we actually, one of the things we've also been really excited about was launching our community. Community.netlify.com recently. Let me just see if I can find, like, if you go there right now, there's a thread highlighted called saying closed beta tester wanted. There we're starting a new beta program where we're going to take some of the really early adopters and people who like to stay on the bleeding edge and invite them to try new features before we announce them to the public. So if you want a sneak peek of what's coming, you should all go there and sign up.
And that was my interview with Matthew Billman of Netlify. I hope you enjoyed. I hope you go and check out what they have to offer. That's another Weekly Squeak for this week. You can find previous episodes at christianschiller.com/podcasts, and you can find the associated newsletter also on christianschiller.com/newsletters. Please rate or review or share the show wherever you found it, and you can tweet at me at Chris Chinch and find further details on the website I just mentioned. In the meantime, if you have been, thank you very much for listening.
I'm Cindy Lauper with fellow Cosentyx advocate, Chef Michelle Bernstein.
We'll share our experiences with plaque psoriasis, with psoriatic arthritis, and Dr. Panico will talk about the possible connection.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis 300 milligram dose and adults with active psoriatic arthritis 150 milligram dose. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for TB, serious allergic reactions, severe skin reactions that look like eczema, and an increased risk of infections, some fatal, have occurred. It may lower your ability to fight infections, so tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if IBD symptoms develop or worsen. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or cosentyx.com/Cindy.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 7. My trip to South Dakota was the best summer ever. Now I don't need to go to Mars, because I've been to the Badlands. And I caught a bigger walleye than Dad when we went to the Missouri River. Then I rode my bike through these huge rocks called Needles. Ooh, I also saw my first herd of bison, even a fuzzy furry baby one. I can't wait to go back and see more. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.